Tuesday, September 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, European ministers meet to discuss the migrant crisis. We speak with a representative of a human rights organization.
They need to realize that this is an absolute necessity. This crisis, as they call it, will not go away.
Pope Francis arrives in Washington later today, and we hear about the final season of the British hit television show, Downton Abbey. It's all ahead. European Union Interior Ministers are meeting Tuesday to discuss the controversial quota plan to distribute more than 100,000 migrants among the nations. The meeting comes after the European Parliament approved the plan last week. But some Eastern European nations say they will not go along with it. On Monday, Hungary's Parliament authorized its army to use non-lethal force against migrants who try to enter the country illegally. I spoke with Barbara Chernyuzakova, Hungary researcher at Amnesty International in London. At the moment, your organization has been critical of the Hungarian government because recently, you know, Hungary has employed military to try to secure its borders. How do you think Hungary could improve the situation as the migrants continue to arrive?
Hungary needs to start respecting international law and also EU law in the first place. The response so far that we have observed so far has been one of militarization and enforcement of the border. But it doesn't really focus on the fact that it has also obligations to protect people who are escaping wars, conflicts, and situations where their lives are at risk. So far, what we have seen is that Hungary has sealed off the border with Serbia and introduced legislation that criminalizes entry through the border. The Hungarian authorities are saying that people should be entering legally through the border checkpoints, but we've been monitoring the situation in these checkpoints, and in general, people completely lack information that it's actually possible and also lack information about the procedure at these border crossing so-called transit zones. The ones that we spoke to and the decisions that we have seen have been rejected on the basis that these people entered Hungary through Serbia, and Hungary considers Serbia a safe third country. So anybody who enters this way is deemed ineligible for international protection in Hungary. From our perspective, based on research carried out recently, Serbia is not a safe third country. It doesn't have efficient asylum system. It doesn't have facilities to house thousands of refugees. And this politics of keeping refugees out on the Serbian side is therefore highly irresponsible, especially as the colder months are approaching and these people might be simply left out sleeping rough and without adequate facilities available to them.
As the EU ministers are meeting, this crisis is unfolding. Do you think that there will be a way that they can put together a sort of coherent plan to deal with the influx of people?
They need to realize that this is an absolute necessity. This crisis, as they call it, will not go away. People keep entering Europe or the territory of the EU and are attempting to enter. And there is simply no way how this is going to be resolved by enforcing the borders and not thinking in terms of ensuring access to which these people are actually entitled to under international human rights law, and ensuring that there is adequate procedure for those that need protection and that will be ensured access to reception facilities, etc., etc. But so far, there has been quite a bit of lack of political will to radically reconsider the common asylum policies of the EU and to also show a greater level of solidarity with the member states that are on the front line of the EU. But then also, we are very critical towards the member states that are actually on the front line, such as Hungary, Bulgaria, or Greece, which have done very little to improve the situation in there. And Hungary is just a very recent example how the policies in general are really trying to keep people out rather than ensuring that there will be adequate level of protection.
Okay, well, I thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
That's Barbara Sunyuzakova, Hungary researcher at Amnesty International in London. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Andrew, what is today's reaction on social media to this continuing crisis?
Well, it continues to be, as we've talked about for the past few weeks, a lot of concern for these migrants, asking countries to do more. VOAnews.com, the Voice of America's English news website, has a great piece where they look at some Afghan refugees that are trying to make their way into Europe. And one thing that I was struck by in reading this piece was a lot of them saying how they're using these different apps and social media to communicate, to chart their path. So it still continues to be a trending topic. Also trending this morning, hashtag back off India. After several years of negotiations, Nepal finally has a constitution, a new constitution in place. But India, they say, is meddling. India is expressing concern about violence on the India-Nepal border. So this hashtag has come about, a lot of people saying, back off, this is our sovereignty, this is our country, our constitution, we don't need you meddling. And it's kind of exploded on social media to the point where people are just kind of piling on India now and just using it to say, well, India, you have a lot of problems too, and just highlighting a lot of issues that India faces with violence as well, saying you shouldn't be signaling out Nepal's violence when you have your own to face. So a lot of backlash on social media over that. Hashtag Volkswagen is also trending today. Of course, the German car company saying 11 million cars potentially have this issue with emissions, that they've falsified the emissions and it's actually not been cleared by the Environmental Protection Agency here in the U.S., so they're actually emitting more pollution than they say. So a lot of people are saying, oh, well, I wonder when the next Volkswagen deal is going to be that they can recover from this. A lot of people are talking about the business end, the stocks are falling, the Volkswagen stock price is falling. And a lot of people, as it often happens on social media, are signaling out one kind of viral thing, and that is that there's an advisory board member on Volkswagen whose name is Olaf Lies. So they're saying, of course they lied because this man is named Olaf Lies. So unfortunately for Mr. Lies, he's kind of getting caught in the crossfire in social media. And then finally, hashtag World Rhino Day. This is another worldwide trending topic. A lot of people highlighting the great work to save rhinos around the world, posting lovely pictures of rhinos and drawing great awareness to that. I know that we've talked about that extensively here at VOA on hashtag VOA about poaching and stopping that. So this is a great way to highlight that and show the good work that people are doing and raise awareness for the issue.
Yeah, certainly. You don't hear too much about rhinos.
Yeah, usually it's elephants. So this is nice that it's rhinos and people showing pictures of the, you know, the horns being cut off. They actually cut off the horns to protect them so that people can't poach the rhinos. So a lot of awareness being raised about that and a lot of great material on social media.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Well, in other news, Pope Francis arrives in the United States later Tuesday for his first ever visit after completing a four-day trip to Cuba with a mass in the eastern city of Santiago. The 78-year-old pontiff will meet with President Obama and address a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress. Then it'll be on to New York in a speech before the UN General Assembly, before ending his visit with participation in a global family conference in Philadelphia on the weekend. The Reverend Brian Lucas, General Secretary of the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference in Canberra, tells VOA's Victor Beattie the Pope's message is aimed at reconciling those who support and oppose the communist government in Cuba.
Essentially, what Pope Francis is saying to people is that there is a dignity that goes beyond the appearances, beyond sin, beyond failure. There is a human dignity there that we have to look for. And so we see in Matthew the tax collector, the person who was despised by the people around him, someone who responded to the call of Jesus. What Pope Francis has done is to take that particular example, emphasize then the response of Matthew to the call and invite the people listening also to respond to the call, to see beyond the appearances in their relationships with other and to be aware that, as the Pope says, you know, if a tax collector can become an apostle and a servant, he went on to say in that particular homily, is it possible that one day the traitor can become a friend? So he's speaking to a group of people whose relationships probably are very ambiguous. There were people within Cuba who followed the regime, people who rebelled against the regime. He's in a milieu where at the moment there are dissidents against the current government. And what he's saying to people is, can we see beyond the appearances so that traitors can become friends?
Tens of thousands turned out for him in Ongin and also in Havana, even though 10% or less of Cubans identify themselves as Roman Catholic these days in what has been an officially atheistic country. To what do you attribute the mass turnout, and what do you think he accomplished in his mission there?
I think it's very difficult to assess so early what the accomplishments will be. You can get the immediate euphoria, but we've got to see what seeds are planted that eventually will take root. But there's always the curiosity factor, and in many visits, not only of Pope Francis, but his predecessors, quite often the visit starts with a certain negativity, often a negativity by some elements of the media, but the euphoria takes over, and people like a spectacle. People like to be part of a crowd. People want to come out with others. There'd be a curiosity factor that's part of this as well. But also, I think there's probably in the Cuban people, in the young generation that he's trying to appeal to, that fundamental human curiosity of what does my life mean? Where is my life going?
What do you think he'll hope to accomplish during his visit to the U.S. and the U.N.?
I think that the visit to the United States, and I'm being a bit speculative here, will certainly draw enormous attention right around the world. I mean, the White House press corps, the United Nations press corps, has such resources that there will be no country in the world that will be not touched and unable to have access to what he says. This is an enormous audience. And I think he will want to give a message that's not simply a message for the American people. It's a message for humanity, and I think he will build on what he said in Laudato Si. He'll talk about some of those fundamental ethical imperatives. You know, why is it that our world is being torn apart by conflict, by violence, where we've got this massive movement of people coming into Europe at the present time who are fleeing persecution or who are looking for an opportunity for a better life? What is it about we as humans and the way we relate to each other that allows these things to happen? I think that will probably be a key message.
That is the Reverend Brian Lucas, General Secretary of the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A new study finds that 3.3 million people from around the world die prematurely every year from the effects of air pollution. German researchers say that number could double to 6.6 million a year by 2050 if air pollutants are allowed to increase at the present rate. The researchers say that about 75% of those premature deaths are due to strokes or heart attacks. The study, led by scientists at Germany's Max Planck Institute for Chemistry, also finds that 75% of the air pollution-related early deaths occur in Asia, mostly in China and India. Early deaths related to air pollution could also rise at a moderate rate in Europe and the United States, especially in the big cities in those regions. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Downton Abbey films its final season. Chinese President Xi Jinping will meet with titans of American business this week on their home turf. Xi kicks off a state visit to the U.S. on Tuesday in the hometown of Microsoft, Starbucks, Amazon.com, and Boeing. That presents an opportunity for those companies' leaders to cement business ties with the world's most populous nation. As correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Seattle, the aerospace and high-tech industries in the Pacific Northwest offer a microcosm of the tensions and rewards of doing business with China.
You need only look up in the air to appreciate the lure of the Chinese market. Boeing executives say they're honored to be able to give the Chinese president a tour of their wide-body jet factory near Seattle. In a statement, the aircraft manufacturer described sales to Chinese airlines as central to its future and to U.S. jobs. In fact, a jetliner sales announcement during this visit wouldn't be surprising. Another top exporter and a company President Xi will visit this week is Microsoft. The software giant has a complicated agenda. Earlier this year, Microsoft reported slumping sales in China, driven by geopolitical issues. That's a way of pointing out that Chinese policymakers are trying to get government and corporate users to replace imported technology with Chinese versions. Microsoft analyst Al Hilwa of the research firm IDC predicts market access will be the main issue raised by American tech companies.
The tension here is between the Chinese government wanting to control these services and wanting them to play by its rules, and the tech companies wanting to have more unfettered and more to be unleashed to compete properly with the rest of the Chinese counterparts in this space.
Hilwa says Microsoft and other U.S. tech companies also express frustration with software piracy in China and internet censorship. University of Washington China expert David Bachman expects the titans of U.S. tech to be delicate in raising their concerns.
They're going to say, we're telling you this as people who have long partnerships with China. We want to work with you, but the administration is going to come down heavily on you if you don't sort of begin to recognize some of the complaints here and do something about it.
Former U.S. ambassador to China, Gary Locke, can list many barriers to business in China. Facebook and Twitter are blocked, so is Google oftentimes. Still, Locke believes in the potential of Xi's visit.
And I think it's a great opportunity to emphasize our views and to indicate to China that their society would also benefit from more U.S. companies, technology companies, operating in China on a level playing field with Chinese companies.
Locke says the fortunes of Pacific Northwest exporters in some ways mirror the strengths and weaknesses of the overall U.S.-China relationship. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. One of television's biggest hits is Downton Abbey. The British series is now in its sixth and final season. Downton Abbey is viewed by millions around the world, so fans are eagerly awaiting the conclusion. Here's International Edition's David Byrd with a look at the world of Downton Abbey.
Downton Abbey is truly a worldwide phenomenon. The drama about the fictional Crawley family is shown in more than 100 countries. ITV, which commissioned the show, says an average of 11 million viewers watch the series in Britain alone. In the United States, last season's finale was seen by more than 25 million people. But now, the final season has come, and cast members have mixed emotions about it. Actor Hugh Bonneville, who plays family patriarch Robert Crawley, the 7th Earl of Grantham, says the time feels right for the show to close.
Originally it was going to be 5, and then I went and had a chat with Julian, and I wanted to see the whites of his eyes about whether he wanted to do a 6th, and he explained why he wanted to do a 6th.
The show began with the sinking of the Titanic in 1912 and has followed the Crawley family through 13 years of love and tragedy. The 6th season will carry the storyline to the edge of the Great Depression. Elizabeth McGovern plays Cora, Countess of Grantham. She says that the storyline follows the history of large houses in England at the time.
They're not able to continue the life as they know it much beyond that the decade of the 20s. So that sort of works well for the story. The lifestyle is ending as our series is ending.
The show is filmed at Highclere Castle in Newbury, West Berkshire, currently the home of the Earl and Countess of Carnarvon. The castle has provided fans with stunning views of its interiors, including the main staircase, the dining room, the drawing room, and the library. Downton Abbey has also been a boon for the castle, with tours selling out months in advance. The success of the series, including 59 Emmy nominations and 11 wins, surprised writer Julian Fellowes, who thought that it was aimed mainly at a British audience.
And then it opened in America and became a very big hit there, and then China and Asia and, you know, Africa and all of these whole continents took to the show. And I can't really explain why particularly, but I'm terribly pleased they did.
While many of the family scenes are filmed in the castle, the downstairs scenes involving the servants are done in a studio because the real kitchens and servant areas are not suitable. Jim Carter, who plays the strict butler Mr. Carson, says the final servants scene turned out to be the final scene of the final episode, which made for an emotional wrap-up.
So we were in the servants' hall, all the gang, candle lit. Quite a sort of a muted sort of scene, not a big dramatic scene, quite low-key. And then they said, cut, and that's goodbye to all the servants. And then I sort of thought, oh, we should thank all the wonderful crew there. And I started to say a few words on behalf of everybody. Before I knew it, oh my God, I was a mess. And then I looked around and all the crews are like this, all the blokes all crying. And I thought, yeah, it was a soggy mess.
Very sad.
Michelle Dockery, Lady Mary Crawley to fans of the show, says though it's sad to leave her cast members, in the end, Downton Abbey is just a television show.
It's still a drama and there has to be some sense of, you know, it's make-believe, it's not real. So I think it's important not to take it too seriously.
Show producer Gareth Neem says that there's nothing to stop someone from making a newer version of the Crawley saga. But for now, he says that cameras are moving away from the Crawleys. Downton Abbey began its final season in Britain September 20th. American fans will have to wait to see it on PBS's Masterpiece beginning in January. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Fundamedios, an Ecuadorian free speech group founded in 2006, may soon have to close its doors. The Ecuadorian government announced on September 8th its decision to initiate legal steps intended to dissolve Fundamedios. The United States, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby, is very concerned about the increasing restrictions on freedom of expression and freedom of association in Ecuador. Under President Rafael Correa, verbal and legal attacks against the media and civil society have intensified. According to the latest State Department human rights report, new regulatory bodies established under the law have issued a series of sanctions, fines, and forced corrections and retractions, primarily against independent media. Fundamedios, which started the year before Ecuador's current president Correa took office, defends journalists and news outlets that have been targeted by the government for lawsuits and fines. Fundamedios has also been highly critical of a restrictive new communications law that went into effect in 2013. Many rights groups, said spokesperson Kirby, have spoken out against the Ecuadorian government's latest action against Fundamedios. Human Rights Watch said in a statement, "The Correa administration wants to punish an organization for tweeting articles with news and opinions it doesn't like. This is an egregious abuse of power and a clear example of this government's authoritarian practices." The Committee to Protect Journalists said in a statement, "We urge Ecuadorian authorities to immediately withdraw this politically motivated procedure and allow Fundamedios to continue its work without any government interference." an active civil society, and tolerance of dissenting views are vital components of any democracy. The U.S. shares international concern over the Ecuadorian government's efforts to silence critical voices and deny its citizens access to a diversity of information and ideas. The U.S. calls on the government of Ecuador to honor its commitments under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the American Convention on Human Rights by upholding freedom of expression and association as fundamental democratic rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.